This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Watch the news. You're going to be inundated with messages about controlling your weight, diet plans, news reports on the danger of obesity, images of beautiful models with perfect bodies. These messages come together to create a single idea: fat bad, skinny good. Fuquay Varina resident Rachel Herrick is challenging that. She created a mock museum exhibit featuring the fictional O-Beast. It's a creature modeled after a contemporary person with obesity. Using the language of natural history and nature conservation, the O-Beast satirizes the idea that obese people are somehow different and pathological in comparison with everyone else. Rachel's taking her project to the next level. She's got a pair of books out now about the O-Beast called The Guide to the North American O-Beast. It's a two-book set, combines real scholarly articles with fake scholarship about the fictional character. Rachel Herrick joins us now in the studio along with her husband, Carl Dyke. He's one of the contributors to the book, teaches history at Methodist University in Fayetteville. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Oh, so good to be here.
Also on the phone, Marilyn Wan. She is the author and a self-described fat activist and a contributor to the O-Beast book. Welcome, Marilyn.
Oh, hey.
Good to have you here. Rachel, you've been on the show before. You talked a little bit about the O-Beast, but tell us again about the O-Beast and give us the background.
Well, the North American O-Beast is performed by me wearing a muumuu. It's an absurd animal that I created and to kind of have fun with this idea of what we do when we dehumanize fat, when we make it a medical problem or something to be stigmatized against instead of just a fact about human bodies.
So you're like this, you've got this kind of, Discovery Channel, National Geographic,
yes,
the O-Beast.
Definitely, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So this project, so it's a full-fledged art project. It exists at a variety of levels. So in the most straightforward way, it exists as an art project with art exhibitions and things like that. So they're installation-type things, and they incorporate a variety of media, including sculpture, taxidermy, video, and now writing. Writing has always been a part of this project from the beginning, because what's a science museum without some fancy didactics about the specimens? But now we're...
And so what's the impetus? What's the message here?
I don't think of myself as an advocate. I think of myself as someone who asks questions about what we're doing and why do we think about things the way that we do? So what the O-Beast Project does is kind of satirizes the way we form facts and the way we take things for granted by mimicking these legitimizing institutions. So if science tells us that something is true, we say, yeah, that's true. And if a museum tells us something that is true, if they place it, simply placing it in a glass vitrine case, it takes on a whole other weight. So there are these cues for us about true, not true, trustworthy, not trustworthy. And so I'm playing with that by making something that is absurd look for all the world like it's a trustworthy museum institution with all kinds of research and conservation efforts and all of that. So it's calling into question, why do we believe the things that we believe?
And Marilyn, I know you have some ideas about precisely what it is we believe and why we should be challenging those beliefs, particularly when it comes to the subject of obesity.
Oh, it starts with even the words that we choose to use to describe people who weigh more than average. Because I appreciate that a lot of people say overweight or obese, but I find both of those words carry the assumption of that there's a normal or right weight, and also that you can judge a person's health by their weight. And I disagree with both of those beliefs. So I really like the F word. I like to say fat. Because there's nothing negative or wrong in that word unless we put it there. And our society has, for the last 50 or 60 years, very actively been putting a positive attitude onto fat. And as a fat activist, I reclaim that word and question all of those negative beliefs. I think it's actually much better for society, for social justice, and also better for our health not to define everyone in terms of weight.
Well, let's sort a couple of things out, because it's one thing to look at a person and decide that they are fat, and then there's this sort of medicalization of obesity, which does seem to have some medical validity. It's something that you want us to be careful to sort through, Marilyn. Make the distinction for us.
You know, just because someone's wearing a white lab coat or has an MD doesn't mean that they are infallible or that they haven't also absorbed all of the prejudices that we all live in. And I'm very sad to note that so-called obesity science doesn't behave a lot like what I would think of as science. And one of the basic ways it doesn't is people are insisting on confusing correlation with causation. Mm-hmm. So just because we see a slight correlation or some increase in health risk for fat people, we're assuming that the fat is what's causing the problem. And there are all sorts of other reasons why fat people might be prone to illness. We know that living with discrimination makes people sicker and live shorter lives. We know that fat people have barriers to health care. The reason that I'm a fat activist is that I was simply outright denied health insurance. It's an industry-wide practice based on what I weigh. So that's our society saying, you don't deserve antibiotics when you get a sinus infection. We'd rather you just die. So all of our science, all of the data that is currently being used to promote obesity epidemic hysteria could also be used to support a totally different approach. And I didn't come up with this idea. There's a whole field called Health at Every Size, founded by people who are also scientists and MDs and nutritionists and exercise physiologists. And they look at all of the same data, and they say, you know what? What we actually see is that people who like their bodies and who have an uncomplicated, happy, sustainable relationship with eating and exercising well tend to be healthier. And if we focus on weight, that introduces a poison pill into those relationships. People go through weight cycling. People never maintain weight loss. And it's actually not good for health. So if we really care about health, I think we're going to have a paradigm shift in the way we believe our scientists and what our scientists believe.
Well, Carl, you've contributed an article to this two-volume set, The Guide to the North American Obese, and tell us about that, because you really focus on the way we fetishize, in a sense, weight problem, the way we zero in on weight is the issue.
Yeah, I think that's right. So what I'm really interested in with Rachel's work is the way that she sort of steps back from the sort of the construction of identity around weight, just as we construct identity around other sort of contingent factors of our lives, like gender and race and class and all of that kind of stuff. Not to say that they aren't real, but that we have to sort of assemble them and assign meaning to them and decide what we think about them. And so one of the things that Rachel is up to is this questioning of the way that we turn things about ourselves into things that we're going to then assign sort of a problematic quality to and say, okay, we've got a problem here. And Rachel, to me, is saying, wait, is there a problem here? And sort of beyond that, saying, maybe what's going on is that we don't know how to live without problems. And so we have to fabricate them in order to feel comfortable with our lives and in order to know who we are. And so there's this sort of larger question in her work. Do we need problems and do we need fears to know who we are and to know how we're supposed to act in the world? And so identity play becomes a play of problems and fears in a way that may not be very humane ultimately.
Well, is that it for you, Rachel, the fact that maybe we create problems because that's something we just need to do and pretend that we're solving problems that may not exist?
One of the fun things about collaborating with these people for this book is that having people report what your work is back to you can be informing and surprising in some wonderful ways. So when I read, you know, although Carl and I are married, he's one of the smartest folks I know. So, of course, I'm going to ask him.
Now I know how you stayed married so long.
Right. Now, you know, flattery gets me everywhere. But so it just made sense to ask him to do an article. But as with all my collaborators, what I asked them to do is take my project as these are all people that were interested in it in some way prior to this. And I just asked them, write about this from the place where your current research and interests intersect with my project. So that was the only prompt. I let them go from there, and everybody came back with some really interesting and thoughtful stuff. And so Carl's was that particular thing about problems being problem. My problem is problems. That is such a succinct way of putting what exactly I do think that does put a finger right on something that that runs through not only this project but even he ties in the article through even earlier work. And so it was interesting to have him make those connections so articulately.
Well, let me unwrap some of this, Marilyn, and propose it to you and see what you think of it. There may be something about nutrition and something about exercise that relates to our health. And we may be seeing something about what we're eating. I mean, it may be the concentration of highly refined sugars and corn syrup that are making its way into our diet. So the diet is important. Nutrition and exercise are important things. There is a correlation between diet, nutrition, and exercise and weight, though not necessarily back to health. Is that what you're trying to get at? Is that we need to sort of point at the core?
I am so delighted about good nutrition and so delighted about joyful, fun exercise, stuff that you want to do and no one can keep you from doing it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think attaching a weight goal or weight expectations does anyone any good. And actually, the science doesn't really support that those behaviors have much of a huge impact on what people weigh. If you look at there's a piece of research that looks at all of the people who are moderately active and all of the people who are sedentary. And the difference between those two groups is about one BMI point, which is, I think the acronym BMI stands for blatantly misused and meaningless information.
Well, and there's
so
actually
I'm
very...
from a health at every science perspective, you know, just go for the fun. Yeah. Go for the good stuff that's going to keep us healthy and reject all of the stuff that's getting in the way of us enjoying those healthy behaviors. And honestly, everyone who starts a diet ends up stopping going to the gym because they thought they were supposed to lose weight, right? Just go to the gym if you enjoy it. So the health at every size approach is a pleasure principle rather than a punishment principle. And I do think that we can better pursue health if we just set aside and reject the focus on the number on the scale. And I think the science supports that belief. And I think eventually if we really do care about health and not just cost-shifting inequity and the harms of our healthcare system onto fat people, we'll make that shift. I mean, I'm looking at next year in 2014 when Obamacare comes in, and I'm really glad about it because now I won't just be rejected for insurance. I'll actually be able to buy some. But employers are increasingly using wellness programs that not only offer incentives but offer punishments to employees based on what they weigh. And this is just outright discrimination. What we know from the literature is that 95% of everyone who loses weight gains it back. And within 5 years, pretty much everyone who's gained weight, lost weight, gains it back. So we're saying to people, do this thing, which is super easy to do, just eat less, exercise more.
Right.
But the data is you can't do that. And so we're going to charge you $1,000 a year for the fact that we just don't want you here. So I actually find Rachel's project a beautiful dream world. I just want to go out there in my moo-moo and live off the land and back to nature, eat some berries, you know, keep your Twinkies, I don't want them.
Right.
I mean, that's why my essay starts out, I am an obese, because this would be a fabulous, healthy, happy life for me. I wouldn't have to deal with discrimination. I wouldn't have to deal with people telling me you know, you can't have the medical care that you might need, but you can have your stomach amputated. I mean, you know, it's just rather draconian in the human population.
Well, and it does kind of really ask the question whether or not, because we're seeing science refute the value or the sole validity of BMI. Cholesterol, I mean, all the things that we took to be doctrine are all sort of on the chopping block at the moment. And so, Carl, maybe the question is for you and for Rachel, why it is that we so easily accepted this science? It must have to do with how easy it is to identify that subset of the population that doesn't look like us and say, aha, that's the problem.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is identity play and boundary work. And so a lot of it has to do with who we are and what sort of people we are and how we define ourselves. And, you know, it's very helpful to have an other. And there's sort of this psychological pleasure. I've seen it my whole life in my own family in fighting the internal other that, you know, I have a family that is, you know, sort of in an educated and low-key kind of way, been fighting its weight my whole life. Yeah. And so, you know, who are we? We're the disciplined ones who, you know, resist these urges and what have you. But, you know, it's the same with all of these things. So Du Bois talked in The Souls of Black Folk about how race turned people into problems. And so then you're stuck with that identity, and it's a problem identity. You know, so people say black is bad, and you're stuck with saying, no, black is beautiful. And, you know, human beings are so much more complex and multifarious than that. And I think that complexity itself is a problem because we'd rather have things be simple. And so,
yeah. Well, and I've only got 30 seconds left for you, Rachel. But along those lines, race, we see the part it plays in the criminal justice system. Do you think that in this case, obesity, weight plays a part now in science, in skewing the way we do science?
Yeah, I think so. The fact that fat people are generally excluded from these scientific conversations about their own well-being and health, I think indicates a problem with the system, most definitely.
I want to thank you all for being on the program. Rachel Herrick, an artist based in Fuquay, Varina, her new project called A Guide to the North American Obese. You can learn more at rachelherrick.com. Carl Dyke is her husband, teaches history at Methodist University in Fayetteville. He contributed to the book. Marilyn Wan, an author and a self-described fat activist, also contributed to the book. And that's the state of things for today from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.